From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where every week we deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit. And it is a show where we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to keep repressing and denying issues that need to be dealt with? And keeping your life limited so that you never find the sense of balance and happiness that you strive for. Well, this is a show where we encourage you to stretch those limits and to take the risks that mean delving inside oneself and beyond your own comfort level. And this is also a live call-in show, and if you're in the Phoenix area, the number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet, as I know some of you are from outside the Phoenix area, it's still the same number, 480-949-1310. Now, I'm going to actually start the show today by reading you all a story. And the name of the story is Matthew's Box, and it's written by my guest today, Kathleen Reich. And the story is actually about her stepson, Matthew, who has autism, and this is one of the most beautiful books and simplest books that I've seen that really talks about something that, in all honesty, I have known very little about, and I always like doing a show where I'm not the expert, and I have someone who is teaching me. And the way she describes her relationship with Matthew very often is that he's her teacher and has been teaching her more about herself and about life. And the story goes like this. There's this boy I know. He lives in a box that doesn't show. He is just like you and me. He loves animals and ice cream. I get glimpses of him now and then, smelling the budding roses that have been just outside the walls that seem so tall that really aren't there at all. The surprise for you and me is the box that shouldn't be. Autism has built the wall around this boy so small. One finds it hard to believe, but ice cream can deceive. It looks yummy and all, but it adds to the wall. It isn't dark, you know, inside the box that doesn't show. God's light is shining bright, coming from the boy nowhere in sight. When you speak his name, he may not reply. His box has bounced the sound to the sky. If you catch him on a day when ice cream hasn't gotten in the way, he'll show you all he knows. He'll show you how to grow. I get sad when I see Matthew's box doesn't have to be. He is special in every way. It's just his box doesn't let him say. If you are so lucky to be one that loves this boy with me, open his box and you can see all he learns from you and me. Be patient while you knock on these walls that are hard as a rock. There's this boy inside, waiting for you and him to talk. Very simple, very basic. Beautifully illustrated, by the way, by Herb Leonhard. And as someone who loves children's books like myself, and I have a shelf full of them, it's one that will be on there with pride. Mm-hmm. We're here to talk today about understanding autism. And if many of you out there are like me, you know it exists but knows very little about it. And there are some of you that are listening who may have some very personal experience, a child of your own or a loved one's child, or maybe you work in the field. We'd love for you to call in today and add to the story here or give your impression or ask the questions that you have. And again, that number is 480-949-1310. Now, with all that being said, and with that beautiful story read, I'm Dr. Seuss. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Her name is Kathleen Reich, and circumstances, like with many of us, have made her an expert in the field from a personal standpoint because of her stepson Matthew. Just like my area of expertise grew into dealing with ADD issues when at age 45 I was diagnosed with ADD, which helped me totally understand. And there is actually a connection between ADD and autism in terms of the spectrum of the brain issues that are functioning. So I'm going to be asking Kathleen about that in a little bit. And Kathleen, very much welcome to the show today.
Hi, thank you for having me on, Stuart.
How did you like hearing your book read to you?
I loved it. It was really nice. Thank you. Okay.
Good. I hope I did it justice.
You did. You did.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself first. And the thing that I'm going to ask you up front is I understand that Matthew is your stepson, correct?
Yes.
And it's one thing when a parent is dealing with a child of their own that they gave birth to. It's another thing when somebody is consciously choosing to step into this world. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the choice that you made. And to you, it may not have seemed like a choice. It may have seemed like the most natural thing. But I think it would be interesting for people to know and understand how you came into this world with Matthew. So tell us a little bit more about yourself first.
Well, I have a brother who's mentally handicapped. So a disability is something I grew up with being around and exposed to. And I always knew that he was special, not in the, you know, definition of mental disability, but just special. Mm-hmm. And that his being in my life had given me kind of a better sense of compassion mm-hmm. and empathy for others, and that it wasn't a mistake, you know. And because of that, I had been studying to be a special ed teacher when I was just out of high school mm-hmm. and had been introduced to autism back then.
Uh-huh.
And it was something that really intrigued me. These kids, you know, nobody understood why they were autistic. The definition back then was that they came from refrigerator mothers.
What does that mean? I read that in some of the paperwork, but I'm not sure what a refrigerator mother is.
I know. It's a pretty awful description and very far from the truth.
Uh-huh.
A refrigerator mother meant that the mother had disconnected from the child. Emotionally, some trauma had happened that disconnected her from her child, and it caused the child to emotionally leave.
So in other words, a refrigerator mother is a mother that's cold and distant.
Yes.
Okay, now I understand the...
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And nothing could be farther from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, way back.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't understand what was going on.
Well, that's like clumping into the Freudian thing
right.
that, you know, a person is gay because of an overbearing mother and a distant father. I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. I mean, it's
right.
just too broad a generalization.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it is absolutely ridiculous in thought because most parents of autistic children are the absolute opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have to jump in and completely, you know, champion their child
mm-hmm.
if that child's going to have any hope. So
right.
you find parents that with extraordinary, you know, abilities
right.
that have autistic children. So when Matthew came into my life, he was 3 years old, and I had some understanding, but it had been, you know, 20-some years since I had visited autism and what they knew. So I wanted to, you know, understand it better today. What progress had they made? What understanding had they made? Do they know what's causing this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started researching it fast and furiously.
So he was already diagnosed at age 3?
He was diagnosed, yeah.
Okay.
He was diagnosed when he was 2.
Okay. So let's now step back a little bit in terms of what is autism. Now, in what I've read and some of the materials that I have, it talks about a spectrum of disorders. And I found it interesting that something I have, the ADD, is at one end of the spectrum, and autism seems to be at the other end of the spectrum.
Exactly.
So it's all about brain chemical imbalance or brain functioning imbalance, or what is it exactly?
Well, it's all about how the brain has been affected, slightly versus severely.
Mm-hmm.
So on the slight side, as you said, is the ADD. And it's ADHD, PDD, Asperger's,
right.
Autism.
Right.
And each of those gradients get more severe.
Mm-hmm.
And the underlying issue that's going on is usually connected to toxicities and how well your body has been able to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have toxic exposures and somebody with ADD has been able to detox in a natural way,
mm-hmm.
to get rid of most of the toxins, but are still slightly affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody with autism has been greatly affected. Their whole body is not able to, it's been compromised completely,
mm-hmm.
and not able to get rid of the toxins that are the underlying issue.
So is, you know, with my ADD, I've always, from everything I've, you know, from the beginning of it, it's just like you, when I was told I had ADD 10 years ago, I'm 55 now,
mm-hmm.
you know, of course it put me into a cycle of education, of needing to know and understand what it's about, and help me understand what were perceived limitations, and also help me understand what some of the gifts of the ADD are.
Yeah.
And I know that one of the gifts is that most of us with ADD are visionaries. We think outside the box.
Exactly.
And our brain
yeah.
sees the bigger picture, and it comes up so creatively with ideas that I've been doing all my life. And the other side of it is autism, where you talk about Matthew living inside a box and having difficulty getting his brain outside it.
Yes. But the same thing with Matthew's creativity and the way that he relates to the world has caused him to excel in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that with certain autistic kids. I was just talking with another mother today about her daughter who has perfect pitch.
Mm-hmm.
She's autistic. She's about 15 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
She has perfect pitch because a C is always a C.
Mm-hmm.
A G is always a G.
Wow, okay. That's amazing.
It doesn't change.
When I was in graduate school, I worked in a state psychiatric hospital, which it was called Creedmoor State Hospital in New York City, which, you know, back then was, you know, had built in the late 1800s, you know, so parts of it were really almost snake pit type of an atmosphere. And I remember on one of the units or wards that I worked on for a while was this girl who had an identical twin sister who was part of Up With People and sang beautifully. And this girl, now that I think of it, you know, was autistic.
Yeah.
But she would sit there rocking and doing that stuff. But when she sang beautifully.
Right.
Totally on pitch, probably as good as her sister who was out traveling the world with a singing group. And I actually recorded her once and let her listen to herself, and it had such an exciting and calming effect on her to hear her own voice.
Yeah, very much, very true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, they do tend to excel in the concrete.
Mm-hmm.
things that don't change.
Mm-hmm.
For Matthew, it's animals. He can list every animal known to man.
Uh-huh.
You know, and now he's interested in the world and where, you know, Africa is and what places are in Africa. And then he can tell you what animals are in Africa.
Wow.
And, you know, all the subdivisions and stuff.
Does he personally have that kind of relationship with animals, like dogs and cats and things, or is it just a intellectual understanding?
It's an intellectual understanding. He loves, his favorite place to go is the zoo.
Uh-huh.
And he loves to look at them, but he has a fear if they come close to him.
Okay.
So he loves to see them from afar,
uh-huh,
and study them, mm-hmm, but he hasn't quite made that bridge yet to being able to be near animals, although he does ride horses.
Uh-huh.
And that's one that we've been able to work on, you know, so little by little he incorporates more. We have a cat and a dog, and you know, but at first the cat was scary to him, even though he loves animals. He had to warm up to it, just the same way he has to warm up to people.
Do the animals sense something different about him? I'm curious.
Yeah.
They're pretty intuitive creatures, and very often they know when they're required to be part of the healing process. So I'm curious as to whether the animals take to him in a different way than they might to other kids.
Yes, they do. They do. The dog has done that. And an interesting thing happened also is that, you know, at first the cat was something that he was afraid of and he would kind of chase. And then when we got the dog, he and the cat made friends. And the dog was the odd man out.
Uh-huh.
You know?
So he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's talk about autism in a sense of, you know, we're talking briefly about what it is, but you know, what's the occurrence of it today? What's the history of it? And, you know, what causes it?
Well, the occurrence today is one out of every 166 children in America is affected with autism.
On some level of the scale?
We're not including ADD in that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking pretty strict autism.
So, you know, we talked, and I asked you about this because I actually have a client who has a son with Asperger's.
Yes.
So does the range start with that to extreme autism, or are you talking about just the extreme autism?
Well, PDD, Asperger's, and autism,
okay,
on the extreme side. Back in 1990, the rate was one out of every 10,000.
Mm-hmm. So why this? Is it just that they're identifying it more regularly, or is it just really occurring more significantly?
Well, that shows you that there's something going on, because it's not just that they're identifying it more regularly.
Mm-hmm.
It shows you that there's a correlation between something in our environment, something that these children have been exposed to,
mm-hmm,
from that point forward, because you can look at 1993 and see that the rate starts going exponential. Well, in 1991, they added a new vaccine to the schedule for kids on the day that they were born,
mm-hmm,
the hepatitis B vaccine.
Uh-huh.
At that point, 2 years later, you see everything happen. Now, in that vaccination was a preservative called Thimerosal. So the day that children were born, they were getting hit with a virus and toxins. Thimerosal is 49% mercury.
And this is before their own immune systems are really developed to be able to really cope with something like
that. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't able to cope at all. Now, not every child born in 1991 who had this vaccine became autistic,
mm-hmm,
but a high percentage did. And there's a lot of predispositions and other circumstances that go into making one child more susceptible to it than another.
Like genetics, the conditions in the womb during the 9 months, things like that.
Yeah, and whether or not the child was breastfed.
Uh-huh.
Because that child's going to get natural immunities from the mother.
Okay. So is there been studies that, that breastfed childs have a lower incidence of autism?
It's a leap
from what you just said.
Yeah, breastfed children have a lower incidence of autism, but it doesn't mean that if you breastfeed your child that he won't get autism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there is a lower incidence.
But part of what I'm hearing you say, and I understand again from what I'm reading, this is a bit controversial, that if the vaccines were put off for 6 months, the likelihood of the kid getting hepatitis B is pretty slim, but the exposure that the vaccine's giving them may, you know, by not having it, may actually minimize the risk.
Well, and the only reason that they even gave the vaccine was because, you know, the fear that child's going to get hepatitis B. Well, the only way that child's going to get that is if the mother had it.
Right.
Rather than testing the mother to find out, they just started inoculating all children. Well, that's a sexually transmitted disease.
Mm-hmm.
Only lasts 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the likelihood?
Right.
It's not. It's not very likely.
Okay. So if you're saying it's this toxic additive to these vaccines, what does the medical community say about the connection?
The medical community says pretty much what the pharmaceutical companies tell them. You know, their information is only as good as what they're being told. So they're being told that the research does not correlate these two things, when in fact it does. So your doctors don't necessarily know everything about it. They're doing what they think is right. And I'm not against immunizations, and I'm not against the medical profession at all. But I think that it's important for parents to be educated, because when they go in to talk to their doctor, he's only going to repeat to them what he's been told.
Right.
And he's been told from the pharmaceutical standpoint, and that isn't necessarily without prejudice. So a lot of doctors feel that there's no problem with the immunizations and there's no problem with Thimerosal. And my response is, if there's no problem with Thimerosal, then, you know, are you willing to inject it into yourself? I don't know anybody who would volunteer for that. You know? We know that mercury is a neurotoxin.
Right.
It's known. There's no way you can tell me there's a safe level of exposure.
Especially to a baby without an immune system yet.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, there is enough controversy about mercury and toxic levels about environmental things, where they're constantly putting out warnings and recalling things and stuff like that. How could they not see the connection here that you're putting into an infant, a newborn?
Exactly. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. They'll tell you not to eat fish because it's contaminated with mercury, yet they will inject our children with it.
Wow.
You know, it makes no sense at all.
Now, parents need to know that they have a right to tell their physicians not to do these vaccinations until they feel they want them done, correct?
Correct.
So, the doctor has to honor that.
Yes, and that's where a lot of parents have difficulties, because there's a lot of doctors who will not let you continue in their practice if you don't immunize your child. You can ask for preservative-free vaccinations.
Oh, I didn't know they existed.
Yes, they do exist. You have to order them specific. If you choose to immunize, you can get them preservative-free. But
now I'm in favor of immunization also, and to me it's really good to know, and I really want you to restate that again, because I think it's an important thing. In other words, parents who are in conflict about vaccinate or not vaccinate and what the potential exposure that they're doing, you're taking care of your child when you consciously make these decisions, and it doesn't have to be a black or white decision. To vaccinate or not vaccinate, what you just said means that there is a middle ground where you can take care of both issues at the same time. So say again what parents can do and what's available.
What's available when they go into their doctor, they ask for preservative-free vaccination. Mm-hmm. Now, it has to be ordered. They don't carry it, you know, in the office.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes time for your child to have that immunization, you say you want preservative-free.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll order it, and then you come back. You also have the option to wait. You don't need to assault your child in the first 2 years
mm-hmm.
with multiple vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, start slow.
Right.
See how they respond.
Right.
Do they, you know, have one immunization? Does that child have a fever? Do they break out in a rash? What happens after that immunization?
Mm-hmm.
If they have a reaction, that's a warning sign
mm-hmm.
that your child is not processing it well.
Okay.
So you want to know that
okay.
without giving them a whole bunch.
So in other words, slow and steady is really
yeah.
the response here. Now,
right.
assuming that a parent does this route with the vaccinations, the vaccinations are not the sole cause of autism, correct?
No. Yeah.
So
they're not.
So there are other causes that may create autism development in a child. What are those?
Yeah. Well, just environmental toxins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe where they live.
Mm-hmm.
There's there's mercury in the air. Maybe they live in an industrial area
mm-hmm.
that's emitting that, or it's in the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's other heavy metals that create the situation other than mercury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Matthew's panels came back with mercury, lead, aluminum, cadmium, bismuth, whatever that is,
mm-hmm.
you know, all these different things that his body has come in contact with that he can't get rid of.
And they all scored very high on the test, is what you're saying.
Yes.
So is it an assumption? I don't want to make an assumption, so I'm asking this. Is autism a higher rate in the U.S. and other Western countries than it is in, say, third world countries where they may not have as much exposure to these chemicals?
It is. Unfortunately, though, it is growing in some of the third world countries
mm-hmm.
Because we've shipped our vaccinations over there.
Ah. And we're also helping to pollute those countries, too,
yes.
by sending certain industries over there, and they don't have the same environmental control
yep.
that we
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
So, again, there is an awareness that certain cultures may produce more autism because of the environmental concerns, and yet there's the medical community still not wanting to make that jump.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what do the doctors say who are not willing to see these connections? What do they say are the cause of autism? And what do the pharmaceutical companies say is the cause of autism, if not the things in the vaccines?
Pretty much no comment.
Really?
You know? Yeah, pretty much that, you know, it's something else and we haven't isolated it.
Wow.
You know, no evidence of harm from blah, 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 blah.
Okay,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of evidence of harm.
Uh-huh.
When you have one out of every 166 child.
And it's growing.
And it's growing.
Okay.
There's pretty big evidence of harm.
Okay. So now a parent is raising a child and they're beginning to see certain things where they're developing not at the same rate as maybe their other children or, you know, their friends' children are, which doesn't necessarily always mean that they have an autistic child, but
right.
they are warning signs to jump on sooner than later. What are some of the things a parent would be looking at or should be looking for that may indicate that, you know, their 2 or 3 year old needs further assessment?
Right, and you know, some of these kids, you can see this happening even younger. You know, a year old,
mm-hmm.
15 months, 16 months. You can see that they're not relating to you. They don't want to be held.
And they're not making eye contact.
They're not babbling, trying to speak
mm-hmm.
the way other kids are. They're not pointing at things.
Mm-hmm.
They isolate themselves. They have a super sensitivity to sound, smell, touch,
mm-hmm.
taste even. They seem to be overloaded
mm-hmm.
on a sensory level. they don't want to interact. Mm-hmm. You try to coo back and forth with that child, and it's blank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are some of the things that would give you an indication early on something's happening here.
Okay.
What is it?
So as this child is on this overload sensory situation, what's also then happening, I would think, is the parents are now overloaded because they're having to cope with something. They have no idea why their child's not connecting with them,
mm-hmm.
why the child isn't sleeping, why the child won't let them hold them. And, you know, there's a lot going on for the parent then also.
Yes, a lot going on for the parent. And they're, you know, concerned. And a lot of times they go into the physician's office and the physician will say, you know, well, it's too early to tell, and, you know, boys, because this affects more boys than girls, develop later, and, you know, give it a little more time, be patient, you know, and precious time is lost with
okay.
that. So parents need to be their child's advocate and say, you know what, I want some testing done.
Mm-hmm. And there is testing to be done at a very early age.
Yeah. You know, there are some testings that they can do to, you know, and they're diagnosing it earlier and earlier.
What kind of tests? I mean, is it blood work or is it observational things? Or, you know, who does the testing? And,
there's some neurological testing that you want to have done,
mm-hmm.
and you want to see a neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go to see a neurologist, have some brain scans done, have some blood tests done or urine tests that you know, see if your child has some toxicities. I know parents who have taken clippings of hair, you know, from young kids,
mm-hmm.
sent those in to have a panel done.
Right.
A hair element test done.
Right.
Hair analysis. And you can see, does your child have any toxicities?
Mm-hmm.
How are they on certain minerals? That's going to tell you a lot, and that's
right.
non-invasive. You're just clipping a little bit of hair
right.
and sending it in.
And something I want to tell everyone listening is if something is off for yourself, that's a good test to do for yourself to find out what the toxicity levels in your own body are, what the balance nutritionally and minerals, and what's off, what's inappropriate range and stuff like that, because you know, those things may be the cause of a lot of your own anxiety and emotional struggles.
And you know, maybe there's something in your home that's creating that toxicity.
Exactly. You know, and so that's a good thing to do, whether you're dealing with this within your own child or even, you know, like I'm a therapist, and there are times when my intuition is screaming that this isn't just about a trauma that happened in childhood, that there's something going on. That's why I talk about holistic approach to things,
right.
You know, body, mind, and spirit. There may be something
exactly.
physically that's causing the emotional struggles that one's going through.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is it's the same thing with a diagnosis of something like this. It may not just be, you know, some trauma. I mean, I'm a rebirther, so I deal with, like, the neonatal stuff and what's going on during the pregnancy, labor, and delivery, which has an impact as adults on us as adults still.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's something more concrete and less, you know, ethereal.
Yes.
So
definitely.
We now, you know, we've talked a little bit about, and I know that this is something we could talk about for the next 4 weeks on this show,
yeah.
but
yeah.
we have an hour, so I want to at least touch base to give people an overview and encourage them, as a result of this interview, to encourage them to check out your website, which we'll talk about in a minute, and do other research. So we've talked about, you know, what may or may not cause this. We've talked about what some of the common traits are. What about, I don't want to get into treatment because, again, that's like something that, you know, we could spend hours on. But what about the coping mechanisms of the parent and the family?
Hmm.
You know, what do you do once you deal with this? I mean, in materials that I've read, it's very similar. You know, one of the things that a quote from Sharon Rosenblum writes in Souls Beneath and Beyond Autism. Mm-hmm. She says, with the diagnosis of autism, the dream dies.
Yeah.
While, of course, your child is very much alive, the feeling of loss is nonetheless very real for most parents and families. In many ways, the diagnosis of autism represents the death of both your idealized child and your life as you imagined it would be, full of soccer games and play, school plays, ballet classes, and sleepovers. The diagnosis leaves you facing something entirely new and unknown, and it can feel very scary indeed.
Yeah.
You know, so you're dealing with, and again, I had years of dealing with friends and loved ones with AIDS, and it's the same thing. When any diagnosis that's this big comes into play, it's like the world and your life as you were expecting it to be dies.
Yeah.
And there's a natural grieving process that one has to honor.
Yeah.
So talk about that impact on the family. I mean, you yourself lived it with your brother as well as when you stepped in with Matthew. How did Matthew's dad deal with this and his birth mom deal with this when they found out about this?
Well, again, it's one of those diagnoses, and I think that whenever you're diagnosed with something as huge as this, whether it's autism or AIDS or even cancer, there's a time period where you're just in shock,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it doesn't quite sink in, and there's a depression that follows that
mm-hmm.
as you're trying to come to terms with it.
Right.
And it was really difficult for my husband to grasp the term because he didn't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same for his mother,
mm-hmm.
His natural mother. Interestingly, my husband's mother was a special ed teacher.
Wow.
Which, that was, you know.
Talk about Matthew coming into the right family.
Yeah.
But even though she had that training, what was her reaction?
Well, unfortunately, she had passed away, but
oh,
he
okay.
had grown up with her being a special ed teacher.
Okay.
So there was a connection that wasn't mm-hmm. real foreign, but this wasn't something he knew much about. So he had to jump in and do the same thing, you know. Parents do one of two things. And I think people do one of two things. They either get crushed by the situation or they rise to the occasion and they jump in with both feet and they just, you know, do everything they can
mm-hmm.
and they become a huge advocate for their daughter or son.
Right.
And so that's what he did. He, you know, he started getting information and going online and learning about what this meant
mm-hmm.
and trying to find the resources.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I tell parents right away, the very first thing they need to do is connect with their local autism society.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to be their biggest resource,
mm-hmm.
not only in where to go and how to treat and, you know, how to get help, what they can do for their child, but also for them, because these are parents who have walked that road,
mm-hmm.
and they're farther down the road, and they can help you make it. You
and
know.
So that you feel like you're not the only one going through this. I mean, that's the basic premise of support groups.
Exactly.
That you are all of a sudden in a room full of people that you know are struggling with the same things and like you said, may be further down the road so they have the emotional ability to support you and understand and to be your advocate while you're learning how to be your child's advocate.
Right, because you don't even know the questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're confronted with this, you don't know the questions to ask, and you need to have somebody help you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, what do I do here? Because it's so overwhelming, and there is so much information out there. You put autism in, and, you know, thousands of sites will come up. Well, what's a good one versus a bad one, and where have you had success, and where haven't you, and how has this helped your child, and every child is different from the next, so how do you know that this is going to be good for your child, and, you know. There's just so much.
Well, that's why your site is so good, because, number one, those that are listening, if you go to matthewsbox.com, and Matthew is spelled with two T's, matthewsbox.com, you're going to a site that, when I went through it, it's kind of like, just like the book that Kathleen wrote, the site is easy to navigate, and the information is simply put, and there are links to sites where you can get more information and more information and more support, but it's a good beginning site. I really commend you on it, because basically, you know, you created a website dealing with this that simplifies the beginnings of this journey for a lot of people. I was very impressed with it.
Thank you. Yeah, that was my goal.
It was obvious, and you did a good job with it. So we're going to remind people again before the end of the show that matthewsbox.com, they can order a copy of the book there, and they can even email you if they want to, I assume,
yes,
the contact
yes.
page there.
Yes.
But so getting the support, like with anything, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, I mean, the same thing is true whether you're in, trying to get into recovery from an addiction, whether it's, you know, we've seen in the past that when diagnosed with AIDS, the best first step to do is get to a group of people who are already coping with it or learning to cope with it. When someone's coming out of the closet for being gay or lesbian, it's a support system that is the most important thing that you can turn to so that you're not isolating
mm-hmm.
and you're not putting yourself in your own box.
Yes, and that can happen really easily because you have a child who doesn't want the outside world to come anywhere near them.
Right, including you.
Including you.
Right.
But even, you have a child who's at home, and if a stranger comes to the door, it's meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
So you isolate even more. You don't have your friends come over.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, because you can't predict what's going to happen, and it's too much trouble.
And I would think initially you're even not wanting to see your friends and their kids that may be, you know, having
right.
normal developmental stages and stuff because there's too much resentment and jealousy and grief that you're dealing with, that it's hard to see the normalcy of other parents raising their child.
Yeah, and then the flip side is true also of your friends who do have the normal child who now don't know how to relate to you.
Right.
They don't know whether to talk to you about it or to ignore it.
Okay, so there are people listening to the show right now that are in that pool.
Yes.
Now, in other words, they may know somebody, and they may have had a very close friendship with that person for a long time and now don't know what to do. What do you say to them?
I say to them that open that door for a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Reach out to that family.
Mm-hmm.
They need you desperately.
Right.
They desperately need you. And it's okay to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I, in kindergarten and first grade with Matthew, it was interesting for me being, you know, a step parent, because this wasn't a child that actually came from me, but
mm-hmm.
going to school, it felt just like my child.
Right.
And having the other parents kind of make, you know, a wide path for us, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to approach us. They didn't know whether they should talk to me or not,
mm-hmm.
or if they did, what do they talk about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so my hope is not only to educate other children, but it's to educate adults
right.
to know how to handle the situation and know how to reach out and not to be so afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can be a tremendous source of support just because they care.
Right.
You know?
And it's equated, I think, the same thing when somebody that you really care about has had a major death in their lives, and so many people disappear at that point because they don't know. They're too uncomfortable with the issue of death and dying. They don't know
mm-hmm.
what to say to this person. And it's like, so there are a lot of hurt feelings because people aren't showing up in those moments when the only thing that needs to be said is, I don't know what you're going through. All I know is that I care about you, and when you know what I can do to support you, please tell me and ask me, and I mean that genuinely.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, in other words, speak your own truth. That's what my show is about. Tell the truth
yeah.
faster. And your truth in that sense is, I don't know how to be a friend in this situation. I need your guidance. I want
yeah.
to be your friend. I am your friend. I love you. And you must be going through a hard time. And I don't know where to start. And if you don't know what to tell me, then let me walk a little bit with you through this and learn while you're learning.
Yeah. Exactly.
That to me would be the epitome of friendship.
Right. And then as their friend, learn, you know, get on the internet and learn.
Mm-hmm.
find out what this is and how you can help the family and how you can help to relate to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the child is afraid of anything unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm.
They want concrete. They want things that are going to stay the same
mm-hmm.
because they can handle that.
Right.
And so, you know, when a friend wants to participate in that, there's a process for them to get introduced to that child so that child can become familiar with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a slow process.
Right.
And it's basically letting the child explore you
mm-hmm.
without you approaching the child.
Right.
And so, and that's, you know, so learn about these things so that you can be, you know, a bigger resource.
And if your friend who's the parents of this autistic child is the one that's isolating, you could do something as kind as sending over some takeout food once in a while so they don't have to cook and they don't, you know, like some simple things like that.
Yeah.
Or do the research on where there may be some respite care for the parents so she could actually leave for a day and go out for lunch with you or go to a spa with you or
right.
just take a walk in the park with you.
Right.
And not to ignore the dad either.
Yes.
You know, we keep talking about the mother, I know, but you brought in your husband who really rose to the occasion here. And not to minimize, you know, the dad's role in this. And I know with the client that I have with Asperger's, the husband is just as affected and mm-hmm. has his own personal relationship with this child.
Especially if it's a boy,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Because the dad's dreams are dashed as well, you know? The last line of my book is because of my husband, who repeats again and again that he can't wait to have a conversation with his son.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wants that conversation so desperately. He
mm-hmm.
wants to go out and play ball with him. He wants to help him learn how to play tennis or run or
mm-hmm.
whatever that dads do with their sons.
Right.
So it's devastating for the fathers
right.
as well. And there's a surprising number of fathers. I would say there's as many fathers involved as there are mothers,
mm-hmm.
you know, that have really jumped in and championed their child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Mind Institute was started by a bunch of dads,
huh.
you know, whose children had autism.
Well,
so.
On one of the sites that your site connected me to, and I forgot what it was, there was a section on coping. And one of the things that was there was help yourself adjust.
Mm-hmm.
And under that, it gives, you know, give yourself time to heal, do some journaling, begin treatment for your child immediately, talk about your feelings, which is something a lot of people have difficulty with, learn facts about autism, join a support group, a lot of things that you've said already. But there are a couple of things there that I really want to highlight. Number one, it says do something for yourself every day.
Yeah.
Whether it's gardening, exercise, art, prayer, anything that makes you feel good, even if it's just a half an hour that you can get to do it, it's so important that you're feeding yourself and taking what some people would say, well, you know, selfish time. But
yes.
that's an important form of selfishness.
Right.
You know. But the thing that really jumped out is maintain daily routines. I mean, how can you maintain a daily routine with something that you know is so unpredictable?
Because autistic kids love routine.
Okay.
They thrive in routine and predictability.
Mm-hmm.
So the more predictable the situation, the better they are.
So if it's something familiar, even like time of day they do this and where they're going and all this
yep.
other stuff and what time they get up in the morning
mm-hmm.
and, you know, all that stuff, it actually may help keep them calmer and more focused.
Exactly, because they know that when this is done, this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And when this is done, this happens. You know, and that routine is so important. And if you change it, Matthew will look at you and say, you know, what it is that's supposed to be next.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, so he knows, wait a minute, we're supposed to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he relies on that very much. So the routine is important. And I think it's also important for anybody whose life is kind of just been thrown into chaos to have order.
So it helps the parents as much as the kid himself. What about the siblings? I mean, we talked on it briefly. I had a, just like I think in your situation, I had a client that I worked with for a number of years who had a sister who was emotionally and mentally disabled, or and I forgot the name of the book, but there was such an important book somebody wrote about being a sibling in a situation like this. I don't know if you know the book I'm talking about. And it really helped him a lot. And there is a specialness about what the siblings are going through and how they're addressed and how sometimes they feel lost in the chaos and overwhelm that their needs aren't being met because this one sibling's needs are so big.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do they balance, how does the family balance out the needs of the other siblings with the immensity of what is required for the child with autism?
Well, in our situation, it's been a fortunate thing because, you know, we tag team. One of us takes Matthew, and the other one takes Ryan, you know. So Ryan's got a full schedule of things that he does and you know, participates in.
And when he's with either one of you, he has your full attention then.
Exactly.
Wow,
and
that's great.
And when both of us need to be with Matthew, Ryan has three older siblings that are my daughters that are 22, 24, and 26, and they step in. So they're a whole other resource that's been great to have for him. So he gets a lot of one-on-one time.
But that may not be the case with a lot of families.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's true. It may not be the case with a lot of families, and it creates a difficult time. But if both parents can split the time where, you know, dad has that quality time with the neurotypical kid and switches and then mom has that time, it really can work out to where that child has more of your time than they would have normally had.
Right.
And they don't necessarily even see it that way because
kids
don't know, you know, they only know what they have. They don't know what it would have been.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, and you said something earlier that I really want to reinforce, and that was don't forget to appreciate your child's gifts and praise them for it, and remind yourself constantly what the gifts in the situation may be. It's just like in recovery where, you know, constantly make a gratitude list.
Right.
You know, to remind yourself and ground yourself in what's really wonderful in your life, even when things aren't looking so wonderful. And my friend Mary Ellen Girac wrote a book called The Gift of ADD. She was a guest on my show a couple of years ago when the book was first coming out. And, you know, she said the same thing. You know, when, you know, ADD or ADHD is not all just struggle and chaos. You know, there's some major gifts in it, as I mentioned earlier. So the important thing is to remember that there's a gift in how this has affected the adult's life, and a gift in maybe how it softened and opened their hearts in ways that may not have happened. And there's a gift, and we didn't even talk about how this affects relationships, and I'm sure that in some cases it tears them apart, and in other places they heal things that they never dreamed would be healed, and it brings them even more intimately close together than they ever dreamed they could be with another adult.
Right, right. Because you're sharing things that most people don't get the opportunity to.
Right.
You know, I remember the very first word Matthew said. And I can't tell you that I remember the very first word that my other children said. But I remember Matthew's.
Right. What was it?
More.
More. Okay. Okay. Now, we have about a minute left, Kathleen, and I just want to, first of all, before we get cut off with the music and stuff, thank you so much for taking time on a Saturday to share all this with us and to remind people that they can go to matthewsbox.com, M-A-T-T-H-E-W-S-B-O-X.com, to get more information, to order this book, and I'm assuming it's being sold on Amazon and in bookstores too. Is that correct?
You can get it at Borders online,
mm-hmm.
and you should be able to get it through an Amazon search.
As well as your own website?
Yes.
Okay. So that's matthewsbox.com, and this show will be archived within the next couple of weeks, and I want to let all of you know that all the past shows, I'm very current on the archives right now on my show. If there's any show you've missed in the last few weeks or want to hear again, you can go to tellthetruthfaster.com. You can email me. You can email Kathleen via that site. And I really want to thank Kathleen again and all of you who have been listening. This is Stuart Altshuler on KXAM 1310 in Phoenix. Tell the Truth Fast. We'll be back next Saturday with another show. And thanks and have a great weekend.